Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today it's Emily Russell and Constant Heart.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, there is, as many of you know, a very, very beautiful house just outside Rumsey in Hampshire called Mottisfont Abbey. It's now owned by the National Trust. You can go and see it any time you like. It's a very, very beautiful house, and it is particularly notable for the main room being exquisitely designed and muraled by Rex Whistler, the most talented muralist we ever had, who sadly was killed at the age of 37 on the first day of the invasion in 1944. But this is his last major work. It's a lovely house. The Test runs through the garden. And in the late 50s and 60s, many years ago now, my first wife, Anne, and I used to be invited down for the weekends by Mrs. Maud Russell. And Mrs. Maud Russell was a perfectly enchanting lady who was both extremely rich and extremely generous, a combination not, in my view, sufficiently met with in the world. But she was both, and she was enormously hospitable. And weekends at Mottisfont were the top things almost in our year. It was wonderfully comfortable. We would have tea on sunny days out on the lawn with the Test running past, and cucumber sandwiches, wafer thin, and then a little game of croquet before going and having a little rest before dinner. You know, the whole thing was absolutely lovely. And a beautiful piano and two or three admirably musical people to play it. Admirable conversation. Everything you wanted from a weekend. And so there it was. Then 35 years ago, dear Maud died. And, you know, this lovely chapter was over. And there it was. And it remained fresh in my memory, but I suppose as the years went by, one didn't really think about it quite as much as one had done. And then suddenly, a couple of years ago, I hear from Emily, who was Maud's granddaughter, of whom I knew nothing. She living in Chile, quite a long way away. But she'd found Maud's diaries, and she was editing them. And could I help and advise? So I was perfectly thrilled. I mean, you know, this suddenly Maud had come back into my life. And at this point, I think I will leave Emily to take up the story.
Well, thank you, John Julius. I'm very grateful for your support in this whole project. I know from reading my grandmother's diaries up until 1977 how fond she was of John Julius and how much she particularly liked his singing when he stayed at Mottisfont, whether it was hilarious Gilbert and Sullivan or more serious Schubert. And it's just lovely to be doing this with you here today. I think I just want to start by doing a reading from her war diaries. In Mottisfont on Friday, October the 25th, 1940, she wrote, "Someone reading this diary one day will wonder why I say so little about the war. The war itself is never out of one's mind. It's in the background, always, of all one's thoughts and actions, sometimes the foreground. It colours everything from the food or materials one can or cannot get, the trains that do or do not run, the planting of the kitchen garden, to the thought of the tremendous hazard, the things at stake, ideal and material, the loss of deeply loved people and life itself. At times we talk of it a great deal, at other times not at all, but it's never out of one's mind. It's as much there as art is to the artist or love to the lover. Sometimes these thoughts are too dreadful to put into words. One's mind reels, horror invades one. A despair at the greed, pride and lust for conquest of human nature or the systems or individuals it tolerates. But these moments of complete realisation pass. If they didn't, one would take means to die." Actually, the war diaries do mention the war quite a lot, although she says they don't. They start from the period after the Kristallnacht in 1938, and they go right through to the dropping of the bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. And they provide a record of the unfolding war through the eyes of an educated, intelligent, observant woman. And her mood, as she writes, reflects the national mood on the ups and downs of the war. And they cover events, you know, the invasion of Norway and Denmark, then France, and then the rather strange sense of relief she feels when Britain is standing on its own. The Battle of Britain, the air raids, the losses of HMS Prince of Wales and Repulse off Singapore, and the entry of the US into the war, D-Day, the great excitement around that, and then the doodlebugs dropping on London towards the end of the war. Just a little bit about me, very briefly, at the beginning. This is one of the few family photos I've got with my grandmother. I'm the one in blue, the blue jumper, sitting at the front. To my left, as you're looking at it, is my sister. To my right, Maud's mother, my grandmother's, my great-grandmother. And she was 100 in this photo. It's quite remarkable. She died shortly before her 102nd birthday. And I can remember very clearly the sight of her standing before her birthday cake with 100 candles lit on it. It was a marvellous moment. Then comes my mother, Anne Russell, who, as a little footnote to this talk, worked at Bletchley during the war, and after that was an ambulance driver for the Free French and accompanied the Allies into Germany, across France and into Germany. And there, sit perched on the edge of the bench, is my grandmother, Maud. She must have been, she was 77 in this picture. She looks very fit, I think. I always thought of her as a young woman. Not a young woman, but I never thought of her as old. She was always very fit. She was able to walk. She never needed a stick. She could always climb the stairs. Although she's wearing a suit in this picture, she didn't always dress formally. Sometimes it would just be well-fitted dark trousers and a jersey. In the back row is my father, Martin Russell, who appears in these diaries, and my twin brothers, Julian and Stephen. Although she died when I was 20, I didn't know my grandmother very well. We saw her, we went and stayed with her maybe twice a year, and then there would be teas and there'd be lunches at her flat in London. But she was quite a reserved person. She preferred asking questions of people rather than talking about herself, and obviously I was too young to ask her the questions that now I very much wish I had done. But there was a certain aura around her, and I was fascinated by her. That, you know, I always wanted to learn more about her, especially as I grew older. And it was just a wonderful thing when I came across her war diaries. So she wrote a diary from 1937 to 1937 to 1977. That's 40 years. She was incredibly disciplined. She would write the diary usually on a Sunday morning when she was sitting up in bed. She'd often do her correspondence there as well. And she'd write a recap of the previous week, Monday, such, you know, dinner with Ian Fleming, Tuesday, nothing. And very detailed. She would note the times of the trains that she took, her hair appointments. Fascinating. And the first diary that I started reading was the one which begins here, actually, 1937, just before Kristallnacht. And after I'd got used to her handwriting, I began to read very quickly through it, found it absolutely fascinating to hear her account. I was particularly interested by the accounts at that stage of her attempts to help her German-Jewish relatives flee Germany. And I thought, my goodness, I've got something really important in my hands. I must try and get them published. And
it really dominated her life, didn't it? The thought of all these Jewish relatives in Germany and Austria, and how she was going to get them out of Germany and back to England. She worked incredibly hard and thought, it seemed to me, moments of little else. I mean, it was a steady topic of her conversation, I remember.
Yes. Well, she had, we'll move on to that. There's a slide showing a picture of them, but she got visas, tried to get visas for 10 of her German Jewish relatives, eventually got 9, and 7 of them arrived in England. So when I began editing the diaries, I was sort of focusing on three main areas. First of all, the war, her observations about it, the events of the war, what was happening. Then, of course, her personal life. I wanted the human interest to be there, so that was her relationship with her husband, her friends, her children. And, of course, these rather amazing vignettes that you get in her diary, because she was extremely well-connected, and so she would have lunch and dinner with the great and the good, including John Judith's father and mother. And they provide, there's some very interesting entries on those meetings. In fact, I just thought it might be worth reading one of those entries when she goes to Randolph Church's wedding. So this is on Wednesday, October the 4th, 1939. Went to Randolph's wedding in Smith Square. Winston was cheered when he arrived, and everybody stood up in the church thinking the bride had arrived. He cried a lot during the service. Randolph was correct, self-confident, and pleased. I haven't the slightest doubt he is marrying because he thinks it's time and right that Winston must have a grandson. He has proposed to four or five women in the last few months. I know for certain of two, Claire Luce, the actress, and Caroline Paget. From the church, we went to Admiralty House and had a stand-up lunch. About 60 people there, none of the cabinet and few MPs. Winston was called to make a speech, but got out of it by saying, by calling on Randolph. What could he have said? You are my only son. I love you dearly. I know why you are marrying. You are now a soldier. Soon you will be in France, and before the year is out, you may be dead. Or else banalities. So Randolph said a few words of thanks and that he'd enjoyed his wedding. One of the things I did when I edited the diaries, I cut them by about two-thirds, was I wanted to try and make them accessible for people like myself who maybe weren't very familiar with the Second World War or with her circle of friends. And so I introduced quite a lot of explanatory text and footnotes to help novices like me. Here we have a picture of Maud by Singer Sargent done in 1912 when she was 20, looking very composed. And the other picture is a photograph by Cecil Beaton, done in 1937, in Kammer in Austria, which was the home of Raymond Hofmannsthal. Is that correct, James?
That's right, Raymond von Hofmannsthal. He was the son of Hugo von Hofmannsthal, who had written the libretti of all of the principal Richard Strauss operas. He'd written Rosenkavalier, Arabella, Ariadne auf Naxos. He was considered Austria's, with Rilke, Austria's leading top poet. And his son, Raimund, used to take this house. His son, Raimund, who married my cousin, Liz Paget, was actually our closest, the two of them together were my parents' closest friends for about 30, 40 years. Raimund never lost his extremely strong Austrian accent. But his charm was absolute knockout, and we loved them both very, very dearly. And they were also great friends of Maud. And I don't think I myself ever went to Schloss Kammer, where that photograph was taken. Raimund subsequently inherited from his father a wonderful house in Selamsee, and a sort of lovely, great sort of rambling peasant house, when we used to go there every summer. They were a very important background in our lives, and indeed of Maud's too.
I think the pictures here reflect part of Maud's character. People found her quite enigmatic and difficult to figure out. And I think that they reflect how she very easily moved from a conservative society, as in the Singer Sargent here, represented by him, to a much more bohemian, artistic world, represented by Cecil Beaton, who was a member of the Bright Young Things. And in the war diaries, there are a few tales of how she goes on a night on the tiles with Beaton and a few other friends, and they go to gay nightclubs and they get home at 5 o'clock in the morning. People regarded her as quite mysterious, but I think, oops, something happened to the mysterious, but I think perhaps it was that difference, the two different things that she represented, one being quite conventional in her way of life and the other being quite open and liberal in the way that she thought about the world and her opinions. Here we have a picture of Maud's parents. She had a pretty complex background. Her parents were German immigrants to England who came in the 1880s. First, her father came. He was a German Jew born in Berlin. He was a stockbroker. He invested in venture capital. And he went back to Berlin and married Maria Nelke. She was a Christian. And they came over and lived in London in 1891. And Maud was born in December of that year. The picture, I think, of Singer Sargent, of Maud's mother, she's got a real glint, a steely look in her eye. And I wonder if she was, they were very, they wanted very much to ensure that their two children, because Maud had a sister called Kitty, would integrate into British society and have good marriages and do very well for themselves. And I think, so she was really out to conquer the world, I think, for her children. And perhaps also there's a bit of, that look is perhaps defiance of a snub because of her German roots, but she must have been quite hard for them to integrate, to assimilate here, especially because from about the 1900s there was growing anti-German sentiment in England. And the cartoon of Maud's father, Paul Nelke, was done in 1908. It was published in Vanity Fair. You see at the bottom there's a racehorse. He was a huge fan of horse racing. He owned a number of horses. And the family would often spend the weekend on the racetracks cheering on Paul's horses. And during the First World War, Paul, who had been on the London Stock Exchange for many, many years, was very well liked, but he was barred from joining. His membership wasn't renewed because of his German background, and also because Maud's sister, Kitty, had married a Hungarian and who was living in Hungary, and he was fighting on the side of Germany. So that was a difficult thing to grow up with, I think, for Maud. Complicated.
There was also, of course, the problem of anti-Semitism, which there was a lot in England at the beginning of the 20th century.
Yes.
And that, I think, also must have been a problem for her.
Well, she was very aware of her Jewish roots, actually.
Very, yes.
Although she was brought up as a Christian, and when Paul Nelke wasn't a practicing Jew, there are some early childhood diaries that she wrote, which I've been enormously helpful in putting together the introduction to the book, where she writes very long entries about the unjust treatment of the Jewish moneylender Shylock in The Merchant of Venice, and also on the persecution of Jews in Russia, which I found really interesting. Those were the issues that she was writing about when she was 11 or 12 in her childhood diary. Here we have a picture of her wedding to my grandfather, Gilbert Russell. It must have been an absolutely excellent match and one which her parents would have been delighted by, because he was a first cousin of the Duke of Bedford, therefore very well established in English society, had all the connections, and she of course brought the money, which, because her father was an extremely successful stockbroker. From the diaries and also from the correspondence, you get the impression that it was a very happy, stable, solid marriage. But he was 16 years older than her, and the war diaries depict his ailing health and very moving account of his death.
She talked to him with great love and affection always, I mean, later in life. Mm. She mentioned him quite often, you know. Usually calling him dear Gilbert. Mm. Dear Gilbert, used to say, you know. And I think she missed him all her life.
Yeah, I think, from reading her diary.
Yes, it was a very, very happy marriage.
from reading her diaries till 1977, he is mentioned on the dates of his death for the next 25 years. She remembers him. She's always referring back to him. And certainly I remember her talking about him as a child as well.
He offered me a bullseye. The first time I ever went to Modisfont, I was 8. My mother decided to buy, she hired a caravan and attached it to the back of her car. And she and I did a tour of the West Country. I remember it was boiling hot and she made me climb all over Stonehenge, which you could do in those days, wasn't it? Dressed in a very, very, very tight, small leopard skin pair of, fake leopard skin pair of pants. I've never been so embarrassed in my life. She filmed me, but thank God the film, I think, has disappeared. I wouldn't like it to get into the hands of my political enemies. Sorry, that's parenthetical.
They met during the war, First World War. Gilbert was back home from the front where he worked in the intelligence corps, and his job there, sort of rather ironically, was to interrogate German prisoners of war. He apparently had, by mid-1916, his team had interrogated 65 officers and over 3,000 soldiers. So he was immersed with German speakers, German papers, German experts. And then he went home on sick leave and meets this woman of German Jewish origin. And his first impressions of Maud were, he wrote to his sisters, not an English girl at all, a foreigner, in fact an Oriental or Jewish, very feminine and well-dressed, rather highly strung type, but with the most direct nature I've seen. No humbug or snobbery or social ambition. This is the house they bought, Modisfont, which I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with in Hampshire. They bought it in 1934. It was in a very derelict state. It hadn't been lived in for about over a decade, I think. And so they set about doing it up and redecorating it. And Maud, well, I suppose both of them, but Maud was the lead, I think, in redecoration, were very concerned to keep all of the house's origins, because it was founded as a 12th century priory, and then it was converted over the centuries into a Tudor house and then into a Georgian house. And so any parts of the house which reflected those origins were sort of kept and carefully maintained, and the decoration that she did was to reflect all of that and make the most of it. It also included 2,000 acres, including the villages of Modisfont and Dunbridge, which I had no idea, and that included 2 farms and 62 cottages, which was news to me when I started researching this book. And the previous owner, Peter Barker Mill, had said he wasn't so interested in them giving him a fancy price for it, but he wanted them to look after the people in the villages, all the tenants, properly, as they should be kept, looked after. It's a really important backdrop to the war diaries. The diaries talk about evacuate the children living there, billeted officers. There were Italian prisoners held nearby who would be clearing the woods, and to the enormous excitement of the people, especially the women who lived in the village, who watched them going past, the Italians would be singing and picking primroses for them and flirting like crazy. And also was important to supplement the food rations. She records that about twice a week they'd eat rabbit, which had been shot on this date. They had a very big vegetable garden. She bought a cow, or 2 cows actually. She learned how to milk. She learned how to make cheese. And there are also, you know, not just the war stories, but there's also the house parties that she had. She continued to hold during the war. And there's I found it a very interesting 2-week visit by Margot Asquith, tirades by Randolph Churchill, all sorts of things going on. And there was one extraordinary thing, that the guests at the house would be invited to go and read the lesson in the church on the Sunday. Father was always down there.
He loved reading the lesson. He never needed to be asked twice. But I didn't know they did that at Modisfont. Maud was very supportive of the church, wasn't she? I don't know that she was actually a deeply religious person deep down, but she always went, she felt it sort of her duty, you know, it was the right thing. If you were the lady of the manor, you went, you turned up, you went to church on Sundays, and that was the thing. And she was very conscientious about all that sort of thing, and at Christmas too, you know, sort of going round. And I didn't know about the lesson reading, but I'm not entirely surprised. Mm.
She I think she was, as a young woman, she believed, but by the 1950s, 1960s, I think she'd lost her faith, but that never stopped her from supporting the church and the attendance of the church, because I think she felt it was such an important part of the community. And she always went. She continued to go to church. So this is a photograph of the wonderful room that Rex Whistler did at Mottisfont. He began to do it in 1938, quite a few years after they'd bought the house and redecorated the rest of it. Because I think it was the largest room in the house, and they just wanted to think about it for a few years before deciding how to tackle it. Originally, it was the entrance hall to the house, and it had fake wooden panelling on it. It had a sort of rather ugly fake lodge-type feel to it. And Maud was very keen to get rid of that. And she suggested to Rex that he did a modern Gothic design for the room. And you can see that the architectural structure of the room gives the illusion of Gothic pillars and vaulting arches. She also wanted him to paint in grisé, this monochrome, monocolour type of painting, which is often used to imitate sculpture. And I think this is what gives the room its modern feel, its modern light and airy feel. But Rex wanted to introduce a bit of colour, and this led to a disagreement between the two of them on this one, I think. She felt his sketches, his colour sketches, had too much of a Georgian flavour, and she rejected them.
It wasn't the happiest of the relationships, really, was it? I mean, she loved him, really, I think. Everybody loved Rex. He was the most enchanting man in the world. And this absolutely prodigious talent. Mm. I remember him very, very well as a child. He was wonderful with children. He was always drawing. I mean, on any bit of paper, on the table napkin, on the back of an envelope, draw, all the time. He was wonderful with children because he loved doing monsters, eating hundreds and hundreds of children like that, you know, or fairy tale princesses. He preferred monsters to princesses. But always, you know, sketching in a little background, which was always perfectly classically accurate and right, and everything just poured out of his pen with such incredible ease. Mm.
Well, she obviously loved that too, because she talks about the idea.
It was irresistible. And then Maud put the brakes on, she didn't allow Rex full, you know, to step on the gas and open up the throttle as he liked to. If you want to see what happened when he opened up the throttle, Plas Newydd on the Isle of Anglesey, also National Trust, has a room, the dining room, which is, I suppose, probably about the length of this tent, going all down one side, and it's absolutely fascinating. It's a huge, great seaport, an imaginary seaport on the sea, and there's some beautiful marble steps up, and Neptune has come up there and left his trident, and it was crowned with a bit of seaweed sticking on it, and he's gone up into the town to have a drink. And you can see, I mean, there's 100 wonderful jokes, all marvellously done. And in the far distance, some tourists trying to get into a very beautiful church, which is shut, as churches always are when tourists try to get into them. Little sort of jokes like that, you know. And he sparkled in a most extraordinary way. And that room sparkles too. It sparkles not quite so dazzlingly, because Maud held him back. I think rightly, actually, in the case of that room. But the result is, anyway, a masterpiece. Mm.
So this is a picture of Rex sitting on a ladder outside the room. And next to it is the one panel in the room where Rex was able to put in some colour. He did it when she was away. And when she got back, she could see that he was so pleased with the result. You know, she didn't have the heart to say to him, you know, wash it out, please. The smoke coming out of the urn is a very teasing reference, I think, to Maud's apparent dislike of bonfires. And then you see her interests are represented in the books, the evening glove, the musical instrument, and the letters. She very much enjoyed being part of this process of doing the Whistler Room, and she'd go off to the library to look up pictures to show to Rex of tapestries or musical instruments that she thought might be of use to him. It probably was very annoying for him, but she really was very fond of him, and she records many wonderful afternoons in the Whistler Room during the war years while he was working away. And when he left, she wrote on Sunday, November the 5th, 1939, when he finished the room, "On Saturday morning, Rex finished the room and left. He left quickly, and I felt as if a loved person had gone forever, or as if part of the house I was living in had suddenly been pulled down." I think the diaries contain a very important first-hand account of this Whistler Room commission at Mottisfont, which will be drawn upon by art historians going forward. Just very quickly here, is just a rather poignant record of where Whistler was when war was announced. He was painting the Whistler Room, and it says there, "I was painting this ermine curtain when Britain declared war on the Nazi tyrants. Sunday, September the 3rd, Rex Whistler." It's tucked up high up in the ceiling, and you can't actually see it from ground level, and it was only discovered much later when they were doing some repairs to the room. Here's the picture of of Maud by Matisse. He drew her in charcoal in 1937. It was quite a coup to get Matisse to agree to paint you. He didn't like accepting commissions, paid commissions. And so it's thought that probably she was introduced to him by either Rex Mortimer or Clive Bell, who knew him. And she also had to show that she was a serious art collector, which she was. So she had bought a Matisse drawing in 1936, and she also had to buy a Degas shortly before the sitting in order to clinch his agreement of the drawing. She was never very happy with it. I think she was, I'm not sure if happy is the right word, but she just was rather surprised by that very sad look in her face, austere look in her face. And she used to hang them up, not in a very prominent place. There's another picture he did of her as well. And she'd invite guests to come and have a look at them and ask their opinion, "What do you think of this?" I'm not sure if she put them there, though, because she didn't like them. I think that also she might have felt uncomfortable about putting a portrait of herself by this great artist, Matisse, above the fireplace in the sitting room. It wasn't really her style, because she was a reserved person. But she showed the picture in 1960-61 to Stephen Spender, who was a friend of hers. And he made, I think, a really astute comment. He said that he thought that Matisse had captured a Byzantine look that she had, and that it resembled Theodora in the Basilica di San Vitale in Italy. And so I've just put up beside that mosaic. And I think he's absolutely right. I think they're absolutely splitting images. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, Maud went on to have a very long-term relationship, and we'll go on to that if we have enough time, with Boris Anrep. He was absolutely fascinated by Byzantine art. I wonder whether her looks, that was part of the attraction for him in her. So this is some photographs of her Jewish relatives. Her father, as I said, was Jewish. He had three sisters who lived, two of them were living in Germany at the time that the war broke out. So she spent a lot of time trying to get them visas. She was pretty successful. She managed to get visas for nine of them. Apparently, that was most people, if they'd got one or two visas for relations or friends, that they were doing well. So she used all of her connections. And there are entries in the diary about getting the visas, about going to the aliens tribunal, the police court, to process the stay of her relations in England. On on here we have her aunt, Agnes, and her cousin, Hans Werner. Agnes, they both got visas. Unfortunately, they didn't leave Germany in time. And Agnes died in 1943 in Terezin in Czechoslovakia. And Hans Werner died. He managed to survive the Neuengamme labor camp in Germany and then was unwittingly bombed by the British as the Germans shipped out the surviving prisoners on boats. On the other side, we have two Erla, who was successfully came to England, met a Pole, Utrecht, and you can see their wedding day in this picture. And Maud was actually the best woman for Utrecht on their wedding day. Here we have...
My parents.
Your parents.
I think taken at Modisfont, probably just about the beginning of the war. My father had been First Lord of the Admiralty until he resigned from Noble Chamberlain's government over the time of Munich. And to sort of mark that, my mother always wore that yachting cap throughout the war, and for indeed many years after it, I remember. And there on the right, the smaller picture, is Conrad Russell, who was, I think, entirely platonically in love with my mother for 15 years. And he was a farmer. There he is in his home guard uniform. And he was perfectly wonderful. He wrote her endless letters, which we've kept. They're incredibly funny letters. They're marvellous. I've kept several of them for the little anthology I do from time to time. Broke out, and my mother started a farm, a tiny, tiny little farm in our three acres, which is all we had in Sussex. It was Conrad who came over and sort of taught her how to milk cows, how to make cheese, how to do all those things. And I think my mother's never been so happy in her life as she was then.
Conrad also taught Maud how to make the cheese, actually, and he was Gilbert's brother. And he appears in the war diaries because on a number of occasions, and I think there's a... When Gilbert died, he's there with Claude, his brother, supporting Maud as she copes with the death of her husband. They were household names to me when I grew up because my father, of course, worked for Duff.
Yes, of course he did.
Ministry
he went to Singapore with him.
And also in Singapore, So here we have Ian Fleming. This photograph is, I think, the copy that we have in my grandmother's album is unique because Ian Fleming relations and they've said they've never seen it before. So I wonder whether perhaps she asked him to get a studio photograph taken. And when I was wondering in my head, well, do you think they were really lovers? It's been said they were lovers, and I was looking through the photograph album, and I suddenly turn over a page, and there's this three-quarter page with this photograph in it, and I went, well, yes, of course they were, you know. Because every other picture in the album was just a tiny little, you know, postage stamp. And then suddenly there was Ian. We didn't talk much. I mean, I wasn't aware as a young child that they had a great friendship. And I remember when I read Andrew Lycett's biography and he refers to Maud as Ian's stern mistress. It was, oh, really? And so part of this writing of the book or editing of her diaries was to try and figure out, you know, whether it was just a very intimate, close relationship or whether they actually were lovers.
You found some hair, a lock of hair too, didn't you?
So I had found lots, various bits of evidence, but there was one envelope with a lock of black hair inside it, and on the front it says eyes, because she always called him I. She never wrote, well, she rarely wrote Ian, she normally wrote I. So I assume that I have some of Ian Fleming's hair in an envelope at home in Chile. There's some lots about him in the war diaries. They were very supportive one of another. She helped him get a job at Cull & Co. I think Gilbert was the one who got him in touch with may have played a role in getting him in touch with military intelligence and his job in the Naval Intelligence Division in the war. And then when Gilbert died and she was at a complete loss, he got her a job at the Admiralty, and she worked in the war in room 17Z, which was the subversive propaganda unit. And it was just what she needed to take. She had enough, you know, her life had been around Gilbert, while he was alive, when Gilbert left, she wanted to feel as if she was part of the war effort, kept busy. And I think that was extremely important for her. The other thing that here's a picture of Ian at Mottisfont in his swimming costume by the river, probably just about to have a swim. He's with Angus Menzies. And there they are looking, Maud and Ian looking at photograph albums, again with Angus. one thing that there's no doubt that Maud was a huge influence on Ian's life, and one of the things that she did was she gave him the money to buy Goldeneye, which is where he wrote his James Bond novels. And there's some other bits in the diaries where she is referred to, along with his mother, as one of the two most important women in his life at that time. So finally, on to the last important man in Maud's life, Boris Anrep, who was a Russian mosaicist, who came to live in England. Well, actually, he went to live in France, to study in France, in around 1909, 1910. And then a lot of his commissions came from England and English people, so he would travel backwards and forwards for work, but his studio was in Paris. And then when war broke out, he left Paris and came to London, and that's where their relationship, the relationship with my grandmother, really starts. They had met each other before. This painting was done in 1934 or 1935, and when I first saw it, I thought, that's a bit odd. My grandmother's in bed, he's taking a picture of her. I found these engagement diaries when I was preparing this book for publication, and she was ill in bed from November 1934 to January 1935, and there was two notes during that period, Boris Anrep, 4 p.m., and so he obviously made these social visits, and this is the result of those visits then.
I think it's just worth mentioning that in her later life, Maud was pathologically private about her bedroom. Nobody was allowed into her bedroom. Once when she was away for the afternoon, some friends arrived and she'd said to my mother, oh, do show them round. And my mother showed them into Maud's bedroom. She was absolutely furious when she got back. Anybody could have gone into her bedroom. And once I was there and had a jippy tummy and was feeling rotten, and she said, I've got just the pill for you, come up when we go to bed and I'll give you one. And I went and I knocked on her bedroom door and said, Maud, it's me. You remember, you were very kind, you said, you give me a pill. And after a long pause, the door opened a quarter of an inch and a finger came round with the pill. And that was, I mean, I couldn't even get a glimpse of the room behind. It was very odd. So, I mean, that argues very, very, very great privilege for old Boris.
Well, Ian also knew her bedroom as well, by all accounts, from the war diaries.
He what?
Well, because he watches a video of about Mottisfont when he's in Ceylon, Sri Lanka. And he says, oh, and they showed your bedroom as well. So he'd obviously been inside her bedroom, otherwise he wouldn't have known it was her bedroom.
Well, there you are, yes.
So it was a really very serious relationship with Boris Anrep. It began during the Second World War. You see it developing. By the end of the diaries, there's a sort of, you know, she's reached a kind of decision about it. But it was incredibly discreet, and I had absolutely no idea about it, even though he was living in the same flat as her in London. She had a flat, two-story flat in London, where they were actually two flats. They put in an adjoining staircase between the two flats, and he lived upstairs. And I only discovered that he had been her lover for 25 years after my grandfather had died, after she had died, and I found a letter from him in her bedside table, just thanking her for all her support and love over the years.
And then, of course, there's his work in the National Gallery.
Well, that's right. So let's just quickly move on to that. She was a real champion of Boris, and actually a lot of the archives about Boris in the V&A are thanks to her putting together papers. And she also sponsored the last four mosaics that he did on the floor of the National Gallery. So I don't know how many of you have been to the National Gallery in London and noticed the mosaics as you've walked in. They were done in three periods, and this is the the last set that he did. From about 1945 through to 1952, I think it was, when it was actually laid and open. And there you see Winston Churchill raising his hands, victory salute. And that was her idea. Boris was thinking of putting a cigar in her hand. And she said, no, why don't you put his hand up in victory?
There's also victory my mother salute. As Britannia. Which we haven't got a picture of.
No, I can't.
She's there
no,
as well.
No, I should have included her, shouldn't I? I'm sorry. And the other picture is my grandmother as Folly. Folly, perhaps, for being in love with Boris and funding this floor. We don't know. She really liked that mosaic of her. She loved the hair, the neck. And she, although I don't know if Boris ever meant that to be him looking over her shoulder, she always thought of it as Boris looking over her shoulder. Boris was a very, you know, he usually had two women on the go at the same time. It was quite courageous of her to take him on, but I think the only rival that she felt was his work. He was extremely dedicated to making mosaics. He went on until he was about 80 years old. I think he finished the Westminster Cathedral mosaic. And, you know, she was always trying to get him to calm down and work less and relax and not get so tired. Eventually, on his death, he asked her to be cremated and to bury his ashes at Mottisfont, and they're there buried under a chestnut tree, which they planted together along with the beech in 1945. I don't think we've got time for these, but very quickly, the diaries also talk about her two sons, who were young at the time, and obviously they played their part in the war. We have my father on the right, who, as I've mentioned, initially went off into the army but had asthma, then got a job in the Ministry of Information with Duff Cooper and went off to Singapore with him. For about a month, they thought he was missing. They thought, we hope that he's, you know, with any luck, he's in a Japanese prisoner of war camp. Luckily, he wasn't. He had got on the last boat out and ended up in Sri Lanka, where he worked for the rest of the war. And then on my left is my uncle Raymond, a talented musician. He was a conscientious objector, so the diaries also tell that story of how, in the end, he signs up. He was very unhappy. He eventually signs up. He joins the Royal Fusiliers and had a successful war in the end.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.